Yeah, what's happening?
I don't know. I think there might be a gas leak. Hello and welcome to Did I Do That? It's a podcast about graphic designers and the mistakes we make on the way to making something great because it's all part of the process. I'm Sean Schumacher, and joining me today, a very special guest. She's a designer, photographer, and author who has crafted works for the likes of Nike, Apple, and the New York Times. Her multifaceted practice integrates design with socially engaged art, resulting in projects like the location-specific publication series Rural, which examines the complexities and shared consciousness underlying the urban-rural divide across the U.S. These days, she serves as a creative director at the official manufacturing company, better known as OMFG Co. here in Portland. It's Kimberly Sutherland. Hi.
Woo, hello. Hello.
Recent. I just learned this. Recent podcaster.
Yes.
Kimberly Sutherland.
Yes. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. For,
and then what? Question mark, exclamation point.
So you've taken the problem that my podcast has, which is that it ends with punctuation. You've doubled down.
I've
on
doubled
that.
Down. And honestly, I swear I didn't know, but I love that our podcast names are aligned in that way.
It is always so curious to know what is going to happen. What if people type in the wrong punctuation order there?
They're not going to find it.
Just like people can't find me when they don't put in the question mark. It's a puzzling problem. But thank you so much for being here
You're
today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm kind of curious. Do you have a bit of a sweet tooth?
Oh, Sean. Do I have a sweet tooth? It's out of control.
Oh no, really?
I try to tame it, but it's really a problem.
Well, I might possibly have you beat.
Okay.
And I say that because I recently learned, objectively speaking, that I am the biggest ice cream boy. And I mean that truly, because I was informed that I was the biggest ice cream boy.
What? Did you win a prize?
Yes, in a manner of speaking. Some might argue that I purchased the prize. But yeah, so I to contextualize, last year I lost 50 pounds.
Good for you.
Thank you. And somehow at the same time, I became a bit of an ice cream fanatic. That became my special treat. And I went to a wonderful local ice cream place called Kate's Great Non-Dairy Ice Cream, I think is the official name. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Yep.
But Kate's Great Non-Dairy Ice Cream is full of amazing non-dairy ice creams. The Cookie Monster, which is, of course, a blue ice cream full with cookies. Who does not love that?
I don't love that.
You do not love that?
I don't like colorful ice cream like that.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, you might have issues with Kate's then, because I think they are famous for their colorful ice creams. They also have a really wonderful creamsicle one that is that same like nuclear creamsicle orange that just makes
you think.
Yeah,
I don't like unnatural colors in my ice cream.
You don't like your ice cream to be the color of, say, a reflective vest that a safety worker is wearing.
No, that seems unsafe.
But yeah, I became, as I was losing this weight, really phenomenally into ice cream. I was having ice cream, I came to realize, every single day.
Wow. You do have me beat.
How
do you lose weight and eat ice cream every day at the same time? Tell me your secrets.
I don't know. I wish I had some idea. At some point, I think it was like over, it was at the end of last summer. I was like, okay, I gotta kind of put a stop to this, because this is getting to be this is getting to be too much. And so it became like, you know, like a once a week thing. And then it kind of tapered off as it became cold. And it was like, well, I am ice cream. I don't feel like eating ice cream now. So I received a call kind of out of the blue one day from someone at Kate's. Like, this was about like 2 months ago, I want to say.
Okay.
Telling me that I was their best customer in the previous year.
Wow.
Which is, I think, a very clear indicator
of a problem.
And also they definitely use the language best customer, which I think speaks to the fact that it could be any number of things. It could be most visits. I suspect it's not. I suspect it's the worst one, which is most money spent.
Yes.
So fully a third of my income may have gone towards ice cream last year.
Well spent, honestly.
It really is. Oh my gosh, it's so good. It took a lot. Like initially, their prize that they offered was an ice cream cake, which I immediately was like, oh no.
Oh wow. Oh wow.
Because I'll eat the whole thing.
You gotta share, Sean.
I know. But like, what am I gonna, if I bring it into a class, which would probably be my instinct, yeah, like that's gonna be like, you know, the teacher gets a pizza, a single pizza for their 30 students, and they each get a sliver
of
pizza.
A tiny sliver. Yeah. Take it to the lounge. The teacher's lounge. They need it. They deserve it.
We don't have anything remotely
yeah, <you're right>.
Communal here.
Put it on Liz's desk.
Yeah. And the four people who go in the office every day will get to
they
enjoy
get a
it.
Big slice.
Then it will melt and attract the rats again.
No. Well, I'm really proud of you.
Yes. I talked to them and eventually they offered me 5 pints.
Wow.
So I'm going to eat several of those pints myself and yeah, offer the rest to friends. That is my apparent reward for
wow,
being the biggest
really
ice cream
do.
Boy.
You are the biggest ice cream boy and you truly have me beat. I don't even want to compete with that.
I have to know though, like what is your sweet treat?
Oh man. I mean, I also really love ice cream.
Yes.
But I try and not eat it super often just because sugar is not good for you.
What is your ice cream of preference? I'm curious.
You know, I've got on this new one recently that's like cream and cookies, like cream and salt and cream cookies or something.
Ooh.
Like that. It's like, I want to say it's called McConnell's, but I might be making that up. But it's delicious.
It sounds good.
I love a strawberry, a classic strawberry.
Who doesn't?
You know what I mean? I like a pralines and cream kind of situation. I like banana.
These
I
are
like
classics.
Fruit stuff, you know. I'll take anything, really.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be too... I don't like a rum raisin.
No.
I don't want that.
I feel like I read an article where that is like the least popular
yeah,
flavor of any
that?
Ice cream. Well, 70-year-olds.
I guess
they
so.
Love it.
I guess so.
So if you're running for president,
yeah,
rum raisin...
No,
we need to stop nominating people to run for president
yes,
based on the ice cream flavor that they enjoy most.
I think that's a really good idea.
I think that's
actually.
That's going to improve our country.
I think it will. Anything really?
At this point,
we'll take anything.
Anything.
But no, yeah. I love baked goods. I got a real soft spot for like cake or pie.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, I like chocolate.
Yeah.
I don't eat gummies too often, but I'll eat them.
They're great.
I need a sweet treat after I have a meal, even if it's a little one. So I've been trying to trick myself, like, oh, I'll have a fig or whatever. And I'm like, no, it's not working. So I've been on these little Unreal bars that have like coconut inside and chocolate on the outside.
That sounds
like,
good, though.
They're like less sugar in them.
Yeah.
So you feel like you're maybe being healthy, but really it's just like... It's crushing the urge.
Yeah. I mean, I think I can understand how that's enough to quell the urge.
Yeah.
But a fig.
It's not.
A fig, you're not even wrapping it in the Newton.
No.
The Newton format is what makes the fig delicious.
That's so true.
We don't want to engage with the terrible wasp that's dead inside that
no.
fig.
Oh, God. No,
yeah,
that did
it's
happen
true.
To me once. It wasn't a wasp, it was ants.
Oh, God. But there, do you know that there is a wasp in every single fig? That is how
what?
Figs are made.
Sean, stop
yes,
it.
Yes, the fig plant requires a wasp, and then it like consumes it and grows around it, and that's how fig fruit...
What?
It's so bizarre.
You're blowing my mind right now. Okay. I'm going to look that up later.
Yeah, welcome to Fig Chat, everybody. Your place to learn about figs and the horrifying facts that's underlying them.
Shocking.
But you didn't come here today to talk about figs, as far as I'm aware.
That's true.
Maybe. Who
well,
knows?
We could, but...
You came here to talk through kind of your path into design.
Yeah.
And you were saying before the show, like, you kind of had a bit of a non-traditional, like, path into
mm-hmm.
design.
I did, indeed. Yes.
And it started up in Vancouver, BC.
Yeah.
Our neighbors
Canadian.
To the north.
I grew up just outside Vancouver and then lived in Vancouver most of my early adult life.
A lovely city.
A lovely city, yes.
Real city, unlike this one.
Yes, it is more of a real city.
Yeah.
It's more of a big town here in Portland. But
there's
it's
like
cute.
Buildings there and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Downtown Costco, all the
yeah,
great Vancouver hotspots.
Yeah, very expensive though.
Oh,
but
God.
But yes, yeah, so I got really into, for those that remember the early 2000s, this magazine called Tokion, which was out of New York, and it had this art director named Deanne Chuk, and every issue was like a different sort of like art gallery. Like she would use like different like watercolors or pastels or different treatments for titles and the cover. Like all the typography was like handmade.
Wow.
String and stuff. And I was like, this is so, and it was all about artists in New York and like fashion designers and just creatives and things. And I was like, this is amazing. Like it's like an art gallery and like every little issue. And I was so into it. I collected them all. And
That sounds incredible.
It was cool. And then I did this. I actually wanted to be a journalist and I applied for journalism school. And I was like, well, I should probably apply for like one other program just in case I don't get in. So I applied for this publishing program, this like 1 year publishing program. And I got into that and not journalism.
Oh,
so there goes the trajectory of my life.
Well, it's probably for the best. I also went to journalism school for 7 days and
okay.
very quickly realized it was not for me. That was my journey to Reno, Nevada.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right. Well,
maybe a good journalism
program.
We'll
talk about that on my podcast.
I would be happy to.
So I did that 1 year program and I got really into publication design, which is funny considering what I'm doing now. And I started making this zine called Manic. And I brought some issues for you, Sean.
Yes, these have been enticing me. They're in a bubble envelope.
Yes, there's three issues
of
Manic.
They're so much smaller than I thought they were.
And they came out between 2003 to 2005, I would say.
Ooh.
And they're all about, they're just like, they feature different artists in Vancouver at the time. I'll hand them over so you can take a peek.
Oh my gosh.
I was really into Crows, apparently, at the time, and Distress Type.
Yeah, there's so much Crow energy on these. Wow. Is this the first one?
That's the second one. The first one is the Big Crow.
Oh, the Big Crow.
Yeah, so that's the first one.
A Big Crow with a stencil, sort of cut out of the wing reading Manic.
Yep.
Just aggressive live trace
Very
energy.
Very aggressive.
This whole
and actually
thing.
On the back I'm noticing is it was a photograph I took from a protest. where someone's like trying to beat somebody up. I don't know what's going on there.
It's so hard to tell.
Yeah.
Because there's also like illustration on top of the
photograph.
Yeah,
there's a lot of, I really was just learning about Photoshop. So there's a lot, you'll see that in there.
Wow.
And I wrote these little introductions to everyone. There's a lot of swearing involved and me like calling out people that littered and things like that. Because I really still don't appreciate that.
That's fair.
And then I would like interview artists and like feature their art in the little zines, and it was so fun, and it allowed me to like build community and meet people that I didn't know very well and learn about their work a little bit and you know, practice publication design and working with printers and all of that when I was like 23.
This is like, I was not sure what to expect when you like pulled these out,
because
like I mean they are basically like half letter size. They're like folded half letter, but like They're pretty ambitious.
Thank you.
There's full color pages in there, which I know at that time was not cheap.
It was
to do.
Not. And I think I paid like $600 or $700 to print them, which was hilarious now thinking about how expensive printing is. But that was a lot to me at the time.
Yeah,
for sure. But then I would hold launch parties for every issue, and they would be really fun, and I would make so much money selling like cheap beer.
But like also like you're doing grunge like typography,
yes,
grunge layout.
Yes.
And I feel like you're doing a great job of it.
Thank you.
I mean, this is
Thank you. This is very
effective.
I didn't even know who David Carson was at the time.
I mean, I arguably still don't. And I follow his Instagram. He seems like a weird guy. But like there's good like eye flow on this.
Thank you.
And you were doing this without any knowledge of design.
I had no idea what I was doing. Zero. But also I think that's a really good place to start.
Like this Benny Goes Balls Out. I think, you know, we publish this like quarterly zine in our school, like Annex. And I feel like any of our students would be happy to do typography that looks like that for this.
I mean, it's coming back around now, isn't it?
It truly is.
I'm cool again.
We've reached
as is my butterfly tattoo. Like, great.
Oh my gosh. So there's I opened up issue 2. There's even more color in it.
Yeah.
There's definitely some black and white pages in issue 1.
No, I ramped up.
You really did. Holy hell. This is great.
Is there not an article about skimboarding in there?
I'm sure there
100%
is.
100% is. I'm so embarrassed about
it. Let's see. Throwing the shite and other select items. Just the way that that's phrased.
I think that's
most...
actually quite a good illustration, though. Yeah.
I mean, like, I'm honestly pretty impressed with everything in here.
Oh,
like,
my
this,
gosh.
Like, filthy fucking pigs.
I wrote
like,
that.
That, like, lettering
that's
is
about
gorgeous.
The glittering.
This is the glittering article.
They're filthy fucking pigs, those people.
She shouldn't try to solve the littering with her mouth. I don't think that's where...
And like, why that image? I don't know. The beautiful thing was that I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't really care.
Yeah.
I was just having so much fun and it worked.
I mean, but that's what it should be, ideally. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like a lot of what I talk about with students doing zines is like so much of it is writing, which is a weird task to mm-hmm. have to do as a graphic designer, but like also just like energy and and vibrancy.
Totally.
So I've opened up issue 3. There is a lot less writing, I will say.
Yeah, that one was mostly art.
This is
and imagery.
And it also concludes with, this is the last issue for a while.
Yeah.
As I'm embarking on an intimate relationship with the world.
Yeah, I was going on a backpacking trip around the world.
Were you really?
Yeah.
So you put out 3 issues of Manic, and then you went on a backpacking trip around the world. What was that like?
It was awesome. I mean, that's a whole other podcast, but. It was awesome. Me and that girl on the front, my friend Rachel, we went together.
She's running through a field.
She's running through a field. There. That was my first photo shoot I ever directed, actually.
It looks like it was maybe done on, what were those cameras that were like kind of trying to like emulate 70s photography?
It wasn't. I just used filters.
Oh, well, it looks pretty good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I assume
it was fun.
This is the lower half of that same
photo. That's the lower half, yeah.
Yeah, on the back.
Indeed.
Use all the photo meat.
Yeah. So yeah, I went backpacking around the world, and I was really obsessed with Australia for a while. And so I was like, I'm going to go live in Australia. And we were in Europe for a while, and then we went to Southeast Asia, and then I went to Australia.
Wow.
But I was like, actually, guess what? I need to go back to college, because I'd only done a 1-year program. I didn't have a degree or anything. And I was like, I kind of want to get better at design. So I came back home and went to Emily Carr.
So you like this actually helped to inspire you to go back and do it.
Totally.
Wow. That's so you it like now you're back in Vancouver. Like you've taken in the entire world of graphic design that you've seen and you're still hungry for, you know, for
doing
this.
I was looking at it all wherever the cities we would go to, I was like noticing graphic design, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went back to Vancouver and started Emily Carr and did that for 4 years. And I mean, I started school later, like I was 26 at that point. So, which I think is great. And
yeah, absolutely.
It's totally fine.
I think like we have a lot of students. I used to joke like I started teaching at 26, which is horrifying when I think back on it. What was I doing? Why was I allowed to do anything? But like, like when I started here, we were an even more non-traditional school than we are now. And like, I dare say that the majority of my students were older than me in my first couple of classes.
That's wild when that happens. Yeah. Yeah. So, but the program there wasn't super inspiring to me. I mean, I learned some stuff for sure, and there was some good parts about it. The location, A, was amazing. It used to be on Granville Island in Vancouver, which was, like, very special. It was cool, but it wasn't I wasn't feeling super inspired. So I went in my third year to Berlin on exchange, and that, like, blew my mind open. I was, it was the first time I was introduced to sort of an expanded design practice, and I was immersed in this program called... what was it called? It was like a mixed media program. And the main instructor was on sabbatical. So we had teaching instructors that kind of planned the semester for us. And they just planned a bunch of different workshops with like local design studios and like a trip out to their like chateau in the country to do like a font workshop. And like, I was like, this is rad. And like we did a workshop with Hort, and which is a great studio in Berlin. And it just like really... We didn't use the computer that much. We were like making design analog style.
Really physically.
Yeah.
And I mean, it, I guess you have to if the chateau doesn't have any power.
Yeah. And it was just, I came back from that like a much better designer and really just like hungry for sort of an expanded design practice and like what can design be outside of marketing and branding, which is what I was learning in school mostly.
That's so interesting to think about. That like part of what's pushing you into Emily Carr is this like global trip that you've been on that mm-hmm. opens your eyes to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And then like, you get to Emily Carr and it's the thing that opens you up again is yeah. going to Berlin yeah. and seeing new things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And then I got, so when I got back from that, I was in my fourth year of school and we had a lot of like self-directed projects that year. And so I was just kind of doing my own thing. Like I had two big projects and the first one was called The Bright Side. And it was like centered around the theme of positivity and like how can design increase people's like positive energy. And I did all these little sort of micro projects where I would like like make friendship bracelets and like make little envelopes and like put them around the city for people to find. And like
I embroidered
pillows and like left them in the downtown east side. And like I did all these little projects and then I made little books for every little project I did and had this sort of compendium at the end. And my teachers didn't understand it at all. They were like, this isn't design. What are you doing? And I was like, whatever.
As someone who is also attempting to dabble in socially engaged art yeah. at that, kind of roughly that time,
yeah,
too,
yeah.
I get it.
They don't understand.
No, it was a weird niche thing yeah. then.
But it all kind of, all of it is like informed where I've ended up. And then my last semester, we had to do like a big graduate project and there was like a huge graduate exhibition. And everybody in my class was doing like a lot of branding stuff. And I was like, I don't care about branding, which yeah. is so funny because that's what I do now. I care more about it now. But I was like, I don't want to do that. I want to find something that I'm really like inspired by to research. And I remember like so vividly sitting in my little apartment that I had in my little like hippie chair that I had. And I pulled a book off the shelf that a friend I had gotten at a garage sale the year before. And it was about Buckminster Fuller. And I'd never opened it before. And I opened it up and had this beautiful inscription in it that was like, Dear Diana, like broadcast this information like trumpets to the world or something like that. And I was like, whoa, okay.
From Buckminster Fuller?
No, absolutely not.
From some guy.
Some random guy to some random lady. But I opened up a random spot in the book and started reading it. And I was like, oh, this is it. Like it was all about, you know, how old Bucky talked about the interconnections between humans and nature and systems thinking and how like, you know, you can't have like one can't function positively without the other. And
yeah.
I just got really inspired by that. And I was like, okay, I'm going to make a project out of this. So I ended up doing kind of like a 2-part project where the first was I did an 8-session workshop with this grade 12 creative writing class. And I taught them about his theories and him, and we did this like big multimedia like art installation together.
This is already so elaborate.
It was wild.
How did you organize this?
I don't know, but I did. I got ways. And then simultaneously I was doing all this research on the side where I was like, I started with him, but then I found this whole web of people like in different industries that were using systems thinking in their work. And that's like when I discovered Joseph Beuys and like Margaret Fuller and Bruce Mao. And
wow.
And so I ended up for the graduate exhibit, I silkscreened this newspaper called Everybody or Nobody, which is a Bucky quote. And it had little excerpts from all of these different people that I had found. And I was so excited the whole time working on the project. Like I felt like my whole soul was like just alive because
yeah.
of it. And then for the exhibition, I made this little kind of like utopian reading area. Like I brought in sod, like real grass, and I made a bench, and I had this big mountain poster on the wall, and I put my newspapers in there. And so people could like sit in there and like read about, you know, these people.
That's so beautiful. And I even thinking back to like, you know, the anti-littering,
yes.
you know, mm-hmm. essay mm-hmm. in Manic, like,
yeah.
you know, it almost feels like you were trying to solve that problem back then too.
Mm-hmm.
And now you
still
like,
trying to solve it.
Well, what do you mean? The world's getting yeah. much more stable.
Everything's fine.
Everything's really good.
but then that led me so I graduated and I moved to New York because there weren't any jobs in Vancouver that I felt excited about. And I got an internship in New York and I was like, well, I'll just go there for a little bit. And I, I was 30 years old. I was working at a burger restaurant as a hostess and working at as an intern at like the small book publisher. And I was like, what am I doing with my life? Like, this is not what I expected.
Well, I think you're about to star in a romantic comedy is what
yeah,
it sounds like.
Yes. If only. And but then my second internship was with Project Project. So, and I got that because of that newspaper I made. I had discovered them during that process of research because they had done a Buckminster Fuller project.
Oh.
And so I went into interview with them and they loved that project. And also, I didn't know this at the time, but one of the owners was dating a girl that I knew from Vancouver. So that didn't hurt because we liked each other.
Yeah. The small design world is, yes, it turns out, global.
Yes. It led me into my first job, my first real job in design. And I mean, it just like cruised from there.
That's incredible. So you're leaving the burger joint behind, I assume.
Yes,
in this.
Goodbye.
You're fully going all in on design at Project Project. Like, what do you end up doing while you're there?
I did mostly book design there. So I worked, it was Prem Krishnamurthy, Adam Michaels, and at the time, Rob Giampietro was there too.
Yes, Prem, recent Kemeny speaker.
Yeah,
here
he was
PSU.
Here last year. Yeah. And it was so nice to connect with him again. But I worked mostly with Adam, and he worked mostly on book design. So I feel like I went to graduate school for typography and publication design working there. I got paid very little money, and I worked all the time. But I learned so much, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity, for sure. It was amazing. But after a while, I was like, I need to make some more money and do something else.
New York's not famously a cheap city either.
No. So I had a friend that worked at the New York Times Magazine, and so I ended up getting a freelance position there.
That's incredible.
And so I was there for a couple of years, yeah.
And you were doing some pretty big work. I still remember, I mean, this was a couple of years ago now, but like, I think one of my first introductions to you was like seeing one of your New York Times Magazine covers and being like, oh, hey.
Yeah, well, the cool
that's
thing.
That's pretty cool.
The cool thing about being a designer there is that everybody gets the opportunity to do like special issues. And so you are kind of like the lead designer and art director on that issue, and you do the cover design. And it's always a collaboration with like the photo team and the writers and the other illustrators and artists and things like that. But those were cool because you got to kind of set the tone for the whole design of the issue, and all the other designers had to kind of follow your lead. And
oh, interesting.
It was great. Yeah.
So it kind of ends up being like an art director role in a way, doing the cover.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I would
yeah.
not have guessed that.
Well, you do the cover, but you also do the whole in like the like layout of the interior.
Oh, you're doing the feature.
Yeah. Like the feature well and stuff. Yeah.
Interesting.
One of the best ones I did was, it was the year, it must have been 2014, I think. And it was the year that, Massimo Vignelli died.
Oh, yes.
And I was just forgetting his name for a second. And so I did the whole, and it was the Lives They Lived issue, which is the one that happens at the end of the year. That's about all the people that have passed away that year.
The New York Times Magazine's in memoriam
exactly.
section.
Yes.
Except
and
there's
so,
not people applauding for each one.
Exactly. So I made the
ooh,
whole.
That one's tepid. Oh, boy.
So I made the whole issue an homage to him and used, you know, his typography and his like his specific colors and even like the body copy, which never usually gets changed in the Times because it's all very like precise and word count and all of that. But I was able to like change the body copy to like his body copy that he would use. And I ended up getting a letter from his son saying how his dad would have been so happy about the issue and impressed with it. And I was just like, oh my God,
that's really cool.
It felt good. Yeah.
That's a great story about two systems clashing together and seeing which one wins.
Yes.
Vignelli famously fairly rigid about his choices.
Yes. Yeah. I will say one of the failures or mistakes that you were mentioning was there, where I was working on a well story for the like cover page. I cropped a photographer's photo.
Oh, they don't love that.
And the photo director came over to my desk and started screaming at. It was luckily before it went out to print, but she started screaming at me, and I was so embarrassed and just like so ashamed. And I've never cropped anything ever since. Don't crop artists' work.
Photographers are generally a little
they don't like
selective about their crops.
Yeah. So, you know, lesson learned.
Yeah, you know, it's a difficult way to learn that lesson.
Yeah,
but
wasn't great.
I guess it would have been worse if it had actually gone out.
It would have. Yeah, it definitely would have. Yeah. Yeah. So, but anyways, after that, when I started at Project Projects, I got a position there. It was a small studio, but I got a position there because Molly Sherman used to be in that position, and she moved to Portland to do the social practice MFA program.
So yes.
I learned about the program through Molly and her leaving Project Projects and me taking over her role.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Talk about, that's another, like, it's a small world,
I know,
in design.
For sure.
Kind of.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, I had been looking for something else. Like, I really wanted some intersecting lines into my design practice. I was feeling really burnt out on New York. I also had my own studio for a minute there called Full Time Part Time with a friend. And we were just, like, working all the time. And
I mean, the name certainly implies it.
Yeah.
It's full time and then part time,
exactly,
on top of it.
Exactly.
That's too much time.
It's too much time. There's not enough of it.
It's all the time. There's no more time.
I know. So I was really looking for something else. And yeah, so I ended up moving here to do that MFA program, the social practice program.
Yes. And that was, I want to say,
2015.
Was it really that late?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been here a long time. I remember a lot of things before that. Oh no. Yeah, so 2015, like, yeah. you're like getting out of the times, you're coming here to Portland, Oregon.
Much to my father's chagrin. Yes.
Oh, really?
He was like, "Well, I don't understand you. Why are you leaving this good job?" Like, I was making pretty good money and, like, I had a good position and, you know, I had a good career in New York, and he didn't understand it. But also I was like, "That's okay."
Yeah.
I got to do what I got to do.
Well, and I mean, I think it makes sense, like, you know, wanting to do the kind of work you were doing in,
yeah,
in like undergrad and,
yeah,
and before that. Like,
yeah,
you know, when you're at a big, I imagine, like, a weekly thing like that too. Like, you really are kind
it's
of a cog in a machine.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's just moving through.
Yeah. And honestly, I kept thinking about that Everybody or Nobody newspaper.
Yeah.
And the expanded design. And I was just like, I need to find a way to that world, whether maybe it's not my full-time job, but it's, like, in my life in some form. And I don't know how else to get there besides, like, giving myself the space and time to figure it out.
Yeah. That's so you come here, you start in this program.
Yeah.
For folks who don't know, like, what is the art and social practice program all about?
It's a 3-year MFA program, and it sort of runs, there's the studio program, and then there's the art and social practice program. And it's about art made with people.
Yeah.
I would say I actually wrote a, like, definition of social practice at some point, but I haven't memorized it. But it takes lots of different forms and has a lot of nuances. But in general, I would say it's like studio practice, the artist is kind of at the center.
Yeah.
And art and social practice, it's not about the artist as much. It's about the collaboration that you have with other people. And most of the time, the work doesn't exist without some form of collaboration.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I've talked to students about it, I've sometimes, like, referenced it as, like, it's the form of art making that is kind of more like design in a weird way. Because you, like, I think in a lot of art practice, you are just not thinking about audience at all. Like,
yeah,
you're talking about, like,
yeah,
it's self-expression and it's,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But, like, you have to as a socially engaged artist.
I mean, they're part of the project a lot of the time.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, if you're doing design, you're working with someone else. It's,
yeah,
probably not self-expression,
yeah,
solely.
Right. Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
But so you're here. You're like getting into this program. Like, mm-hmm, what do you end up doing while you're starting here?
Well, I moved here knowing no one. So that was really interesting. I was 35.
Oh, and Molly would have been graduated by
Molly
then,
too. Yeah. She actually was here and we hung out a little bit, but she didn't. She moved, like, kind of shortly afterwards. So.
Yes. I think she got a job in Texas.
Yeah. Where she still is.
Yes.
Yeah. Shout out to Molly Sherman.
Yeah. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Molly. She's the best.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was an interesting, like, restart again. Like, I moved to New York and kind of restarted, and then I moved here and kind of restarted. And I don't know. I like that about life. But I mean, the first year I was so burnt on design, I didn't want to do design at all.
And I understand Harold the feeling.
Wanted me to do design stuff because it's really helpful to have a designer in the program. And I was like, nope, not doing it. So.
Can I tell you, that was my exact experience coming here.
Yes.
It's such a fascinating thing to be like, you think you're out, but you're just going to get
they
pulled
want
right
you
back,
back
in.
I applied for two grad schools. One was in at the Sandberg Institute in the Netherlands.
Oh, wow.
Which is like the master's program to, I think, the Rietveld Academy. And they have a really cool program where they have these temporary master's programs where like artists will teach master's programs, and it just happens one time. And so for like 2 years, you can take this program, and then it never exists again.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And there was this
there
was this one called System D, which was all about like alternative ways of living in the world. And the small cohort would travel around Europe and like learn from all these different like sort of alternative communities about how they sort of engage with the world outside of sort of dominant norms.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, please. And then I didn't get in. I won't tell you why, but well, it's because I didn't know I had my interview until the day of my interview, and I was on vacation and I had been up really late the night before.
Well, what the hell on that
having
part?
A really good time, and so I was wildly hungover for my interview.
Why didn't they tell you sooner than the day
I know
of?
It's a bit rude, and also why didn't I just not like email them back that day and be like, sorry.
Well, they're talking to people across the world.
Yeah.
Like that's not how anything works, guys.
It wasn't meant to be. So that didn't work out. But anyways, and I think it also didn't work out because they also wanted me to be the designer of that program. And I was very forward in my interview where I was like, I don't want to do design right now.
Oh, so you cut them off on the pass.
So I might have done that myself. Yeah. Anyways, my first year at PSU, I was like, no, I don't want to do any design. I was still doing freelance. Like, I went back to New York for the Christmas break and worked at the Times. And then in the summer, I actually, was that summer? No, that summer in 2016, my first summer here, I was planning on going back and forth to New York, like, mostly, but I ended up staying here and working at OMFGCO for the summer. I was filling in for somebody that was on maternity leave, so that's how I kind of met them initially. But I wasn't doing any other design. And then I started working on projects that, you know, had sort of interesting like social practice components to them, but they needed some communication ephemera or some branding.
I would say it's often a problem.
Yes.
With any form of art making, but social practice, especially when you're trying to get out a message and communicate with people and bring people in.
Totally.
Like, you know.
So, and I was like, well, I'm excited about this project. Creek College was the project that I was working on at the time, which was a really cool project I was doing with two other people. So I kind of started doing it again. And then in my last year of the program, I was saying at the beginning that I had this moment where, again, we had to come up with like a graduate project, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I was in Vancouver actually. And I remember like sitting at this desk, like thinking about it. And I swear the creative spirit just like flew into my body. And I was like, that's it. That's the idea. And it was Rural. This book series, this publication series that I've been working on ever since. But I came up with this idea, and, you know, it was right after the 2016 election, and there was this like very deep growing narrative about like, you know, sort of pitting urban and rural communities against each other, and
yes,
this sort of like very binary way of thinking. And you know, I'm from a small rural town in BC, and it's not so rural anymore, but it used to be. And I was like, that's just, this is no way of like moving forward in any sort of positive direction. Like, we need to listen to each other. And I want to go talk to people myself about their experiences and their realities and try to understand what's going on. And so I was like, I'm going to do that. So I ended up going to Joseph and in Oregon and doing a residency at this hotel there, the Jennings, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just really following my intuition. I was like, okay, I'm going to meet as many people as I can while I'm here.
This must have been very early on in the Jennings Hotels. Like, they have an ongoing artist residency,
yeah.
Although they're kind of up for sale, they I want to say, right now. So yeah. I don't know how long that's going to be still true. But were you like one of the first artists in residence?
I might have been one of the first. Yeah, they had been open, I think, for a year or two at least. But I don't think they'd had many. And they definitely hadn't had any like social practice residents. They were mostly like crafts, like, you know, weavers or painters or more capital A artist people, yeah. I would say. So, but I my friend of mine that I met at OMFGCO actually was working there and was part of like running the show up there. And so they kind of trusted me to, I was like, I'll figure it out. And that's actually a huge problem with social practice is like, even applying for grants and things, you're like, I don't exactly know what the end product is going to be here because we have to do the thing together with the people before it, you know? So it's nice to have that trust. And I just went up there and I started walking around and meeting people, and they also put me in touch with a few people in the town, and I just started interviewing people and like doing various things with them. So, you know, I went on a 10-mile run in the snowy mountains of Joseph, and I don't run.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been intense.
I didn't die. Somehow I did not die. I don't know how, but
you didn't fall down 85 times like I did when there was ice on the sidewalk.
No, I did pretty good, honestly. I went on a road trip with somebody, like meals at people's houses, walks. I helped somebody on their farm, just like various things depending on what's going on in people's lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk to them about, their realities and what they're thinking about and how they think about like the natural landscape. And like the whole project is really looking at how place impacts the way that people engage with their community, the way they think about land, their values, the ways they think about freedom or creativity, their work, like, you know, all of these things. And
like looking for shared values, essentially
looking for shared values, but also just like trying to understand people's realities. Yeah. Like, you know, everybody's making decisions based off of their realities, and we all live in different realities, and it's defined by our communities and our culture, and those are different in different places. And it doesn't mean that somebody is necessarily bad because they don't have the same political views as you. I've learned so much through this project about people and like my own expectations of what I think people are going to be like. Like in Joseph, for example, I met with he's the county commissioner. He was a fifth generation cattle rancher. And, you know, we had this conversation that was so insightful and just interesting and confusing at the same time, where he like calls himself an environmentalist but also supports the dismantling of the EPA.
Oh,
because
interesting.
Yes, exactly. Because he knows how to take care of the land properly, and he's not going to take too much.
Mm.
And I was like, well, that's great that you understand that and will like live in that practice, but that doesn't mean that other people are thinking the same way and aren't going to like pillage the earth like they've been doing. You know what I mean?
I don't think Monsanto is as concerned with sustainable ranching.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. So I'm like, don't you think there needs to be like rules in place for those people? And he was like, I just don't think that's real. And I was like, well, okay, all right. But, you know, but also...
Wow. I wish I could just say I don't think certain things are real.
Yeah, I'm like, okay. But also...
Hats, I don't think they're real.
Like, I have a lot of respect for him in a lot of ways. And I think that there's certain things that he does that are great and are like very valuable to that community. And just because, like, you know, we have that different viewpoint doesn't make him a bad person. Like,
yeah,
the relationship that I now have with this man is, I mean, we don't keep in touch a ton, but some people, there's usually like one or two people in every town that I do keep in touch with, and they're just like very special relationships. And anyways, I think I went on a tangent.
No,
but
I think that was great.
But the one thing about the project I want to say is that so I go to these towns, I meet people who've lived there for a long time, I do these interviews and like have these experiences with them, and then I make these books that live in, usually I'm based in some sort of hotel or place of lodging, so they live in the room, so when people come and stay in this town, they can learn a little bit about the people that live there and the culture there. I also have issues that live in the public library, and then with all the participants. And then in every town that I do the project in, all the participants become like free subscribers, so they get any future or past issues of the book, so it's a sort of like connection point between different rural places.
That's beautiful.
And I just love it so much. I love working on it. Like, fills my heart with joy.
Well, it's such a special thing. Like, I mean, I know like that's in a weird way you started doing projects like this.
I have one of
you
them
have
with me.
One.
It's the first issue.
Oh, it's really
I've
beautiful.
Now put out three.
Oh my God. I've seen these digitally, but I've not actually seen one in person. These are debossed. Are these foil stamps?
Foil, yeah. All of them have foil stamping. I really put a lot of like thought into the materiality of the books. Like it's a very, there's like a lot of like intimacy in the project in a way. Like I'm in people's homes. Like we're talking about our lives in like kind of a deep way. And then when people that visit the town find these books, they're usually in their hotel rooms, maybe in their beds. And so, you know, I think a lot about the tactility of the paper and the colors. Always, I want them to relate to the place in some way. So the first issue, the cover relates to the Wallawa Lake, which is in Joseph. It has this kind of like teal color to it. And then the sage grass is the color of the paper on the interior.
Yeah, there's a quote from Janine Tippett on the cover. You have to learn to love the wind if you live here, because the wind lives here.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'll be visiting Joseph, Oregon anytime soon. The wind is my enemy, and
Beautiful, beautiful place. Janie Tippett.
Oh, Janie Tippett. Did I say Janine Tippett? Yeah. You know,
she's
Janine Tippett,
amazing.
The Ghostbusters secretary.
She's amazing. She's like 80, in her late 80s now, I think, and like a writer and such a badass. Always out there cutting wood and riding a horse around and just like,
damn, that
I've met so many salt
good.
Of the earth people through this project. It's insane.
I think I would be perfectly happy living that life at 80. Know a lot of people who would be too.
Yes.
Maybe I'm living my life wrong, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
These are so beautiful.
Thank you so much.
These are like packed full of like interviews with different people, like, you know, kind of profile style, mm-hmm. and then just like really gorgeous photography. And you did all the photography for these too.
I did all the photography.
That's kind of the other aspect of your practice that we've not really touched on is,
well,
like, you're
it's
a really
funny
good
that you
photographer.
You introduced me as a photographer, which I've never been called before, nor do I think of myself as.
I think I may have nabbed that bit from a interview you did about issue two.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I mean, yes, I do take all the photography. There's always a couple that like I couldn't get a photo of the person for some reason, so they send me something. But most of it is mine. And then I do all the design, and I have a copywriter that I work with.
There's a whole army of people working on these too.
Yeah, that one was because it was part of my graduate project. It had a lot more collaborators, but
there's a lot of names I know on this list.
Yes. Takes a village.
And a proper colophone too.
Yes, thank you.
Always appreciate
that. I mean, those Projects books taught me.
Yeah. Yeah. So useful for teaching type when
Indeed.
You can actually say like, oh, this is the typeface. Yeah. You don't have to look for it for 6 hours.
Yeah.
These are gorgeous.
Thank you.
So that was your journey with the first one.
Yeah.
And you've done two more.
Yeah,
since
I've done
then.
Two more since then. The second one was in New Coyama, California, which is a little town, a really cool little weird cowboy town that feels like you're kind of in a time warp. It was the town was built in the 50s because there was a big oil strike there, and so this Richfield Oil Company built the whole town to house all the workers, and then the oil went away. So the company left, but people remained there. And
so sort of a ghost town that didn't quite become haunted.
Yeah, no, it's still like it's thriving.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful place. And so I went there for the second one and got into a lot of weird things too.
It sounds like maybe the city that Asteroid City takes place in.
Yes. Very similar.
Yeah.
Very similar. Yes. And that was great. There's this guy, Dick Gibford, who's a cowboy poet who is in the second issue, who I'm still in touch with quite a bit. And, he's incredible. He's in his 80s also.
I wonder if my grandpa knew him.
Oh, maybe.
My grandpa famously, he's no longer with us, but he was, a world renowned rodeo clown, currently in the Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame in Oklahoma.
What?
He was a bronc rider, and then I think he wanted to transition to something safer than bronc riding, and so he took on the most dangerous job that exists. Rodeo clowning, because your job as a rodeo clown is to distract the bull
so it chases
when it is
you.
Actively trying to kill someone.
Oh my gosh.
And then it actively tries to kill you is the biggest problem.
Wow, that's so cool.
Like his claim to fame is he invented the thing where Like there's barrels all over a rodeo zone. Yes. I don't think he would area. Like that. I don't know what it's called. Rodeo arena.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But like there's barrels all over. And in his day, the barrels were open on one end. And so you would hop in the barrel to hide. And if Bull got in barrel, which is possible, you
that's terrifying.
What a bad time you would have.
What a bad time.
He at one point had
what a brave man.
Content warning for our viewers. He at one point had a bullhorn go all the way through him. And he lived and he's had every bone in his body broken. But he invented the idea of popping out that other end and then putting some handles on the inside so you could pick it up and like move it with you like you're a Donkey Kong villain.
Genius. That's genius.
Yeah. We were discussing like a couple weeks ago, this came up in class because again, it's a really normal subject for class, whether he stole this from the weird 1930s idea of a hobo that wears a barrel and suspenders on the barrel. Because it's such a strange, there used to be so much more barrel action happening in America. Where are all our Coopers? Where have they gone?
I don't know.
Yeah. Shipping containers just aren't the same.
No.
You can't wear them.
You cannot.
They don't look good with suspenders.
Very uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. Very hot.
Yeah.
Just very, just, you know, it's not airflow. It's not, you know, you don't have the smell of wine or
nothing.
Whiskey or third
romantic.
Barrel thing.
It's not romantic.
Not romantic at all. Anyway. Remember when you were worried about digressions? There you go. What a digression from old Sean. But yeah, so you're interviewing like a cowboy poet.
Yes. He was he's very interesting. That was another instance where I was very surprised by a person. Like, he is a true full-on cowboy. And we're sitting out back of his friend's in his friend's backyard drinking Gatorades. It was very hot. And I really,
it just amps me up, you know?
Yeah. And he starts telling me, or first he starts talking about all the communists in America. And I was like, okay, here we go. How to navigate. But then, so we get through that. And then he starts telling me the story about how when he was like between the ages of 28 and 30, he was fasting a lot. And he got really into reading about spirituality. And he got really into Gurdjieff and Krishnamurti. And Krishnamurti was speaking in Ojai, so he walked to Ojai from Nukuyama and saw Krishnamurti speak, and they had some sort of an exchange where he went up to him after, and there was no words exchanged, but Krishnamurti looked at him in a certain way that when Dick was walking home, he had like an out-of-body experience that he think is tied, like he think Krishnamurti gave him a gift.
Wow.
And where he was like, I was one with everything around me, like I was the same as the tree and the animals, and I'd never felt anything like that. And then he was like, and then a little bit later, I was at a party in Nevada, and I'd never done mushrooms before, and there were magic mushrooms on the table, and everybody was doing them. So he's like, so I took the tiniest bit, and I put it in my mouth, and I turned around, and immediately hit me. And he's like, and I went into the living room, and I sat down on the couch beside this woman, and I started crying. And she looked at me, and she was like, why are you crying? And he was like, because Krishnamurti died. And he said his mom called him the next day and told him that Krishnamurti had died.
Holy
the
hell.
The day before. Yeah. And as he's telling me this, we're drinking Gatorade, sweating. He's literally crying, Sean. He's crying telling me the story, this 75-year-old cowboy.
I mean, it sounds like it really touched him. Like,
yeah.
Maybe some legitimate connection.
But I'm just saying, the layers of people.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
But they all drink Gatorade.
The
refreshing sports drink.
This other guy, Larry Hogan, I went to his winery. He just like kept giving me wine. I got so drunk. And he's like,
you should have drinking some more Gatorade.
You know, like he said all this stuff where I was just like, wow, we have very different political views. But then he was like, also, I hate Monsanto. And like, he's like, I love ballet. And like, you know, just like these layers of people where I'm like, you know what? You can't paint with a black or white brush. Like, everybody is very complicated. Humans are complicated.
That's so true.
And fascinating and wonderful.
Yeah.
Have we been talking for like 4 hours?
No, it's barely been an hour.
Okay, good.
Yeah. That's so fascinating to think about. Like, you know, you're really like, how much time do you get to spend with each of these people?
Few hours. Sometimes I visit them more than once. Koyama was there for 3 weeks, I think.
Wow.
like steady 3 weeks. And then, yeah. And then this last book, I was there for 4 weeks.
Yeah. What is the newest one?
The newest one, which just came out last fall, 2023, is based in this village called Sointula, which is on a little island called Malcolm Island off of the coast of British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Malcolm Island.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes. It's like off the tip of Vancouver Island, like way up there.
Is it in the middle of anything or no?
I mean, it's in the middle of water.
Yeah, maybe that's what that show's about.
Malcolm
is stranded in the middle of, yes, of the Pacific Ocean.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. But this island is really interesting history. So it was settled by Finnish utopian socialists in the early 1900s.
All right.
That were escaping like life in the mines on Vancouver Island, which was awful.
Ooh.
And so they wanted to build this community, and they got this like very infamous sort of philosopher socialist man from Finland and to come over and sort of like be the head of this community. And so for a few years, It all fell apart, as most utopian communities do, because of money mismanagement and just hard life and all the things. But so half of the community left, but half of them stayed. And so it still has this like deep Finnish history there. It used to be that Finnish was spoken on the island solely. Now it's English, and there's only maybe like 15 people that still speak Finnish,
but that's remarkable.
But there's lots of descendants of the Finnish people, and this town used to also be, the island used to be one of the richest fishing villages in Canada back in the 70s and 80s because of salmon fishing.
Whoa.
Which is now completely decimated. And so there's like little inklings of like old timers that still do it. So it's so interesting to hear about that, and how that's changed over the years and why they think that's changed. And, you know, like having fishermen talk about climate change and things like that was like very interesting.
I've heard that there is a lot of like people who are actually out working the land and stuff can kind of see it.
Yeah. I mean, I was like dying to do my third issue on a place that was based on the ocean or like with water, because I wanted to talk to people about that. And I mean, I would say an underlying current of the whole series is like me trying to understand people's relationship with nature.
Yeah.
And how that impacts their life and their livelihoods and things like that. So it was really interesting for that reason. And people in Finland are really excited about this place because it was a legend for a long time and they didn't know it was real. And then they found out that Sointula is actually a real place.
Wait, they didn't think it was an actual real
thing? No, they thought it was a story. Or maybe they didn't know that it still existed or something. But yeah, it's so crazy. So I was in touch with people in Finland and I sent them a bunch of books and they made a play about it. And like, it was a whole thing.
That sounds awesome. Amazing.
Yeah.
Like, this is a fairy tale that's been passed down.
It was amazing. It's a beautiful place. And yeah, lots of salt of the earth people up there.
The Canadian Finns who escaped the mines and started a socialist utopia on an island.
Yeah.
And Dewey from Malcolm in the Middle is there.
Yes. I don't know. Yeah, it was incredible. And then the island next to it, there's a town called Alert Bay, which is, there's like a big indigenous reserve there and a beautiful museum. And so I got to go over there and have a conversation with one of the matriarchs of that community, this elder. That was really incredible. And I'm still really in touch with her. We had this whole ceremony thing happen. It was like a very wild, unexpected conversation.
It sounds like that must happen a lot in these, like they just go in such a different direction maybe than you expect.
That like, does happen. Yeah. At least one time in the book series, it seems to happen.
Wow.
Yeah. And I just like show up with the being very open to whatever might come my way. And it seems to have worked out up until this point. So.
That's amazing. While you're doing this, also you're working still at OMFG Co.
Yes,
like that's the other like trajectory.
Right,
this is not like your whole practice.
No, this is my side hustle. This is my heart work that I do on the side to make branding more interesting.
Yeah, you graduate from the Art and Social Practice program, and then do you go like, does that like transition into OMFG Co right away?
No. So also while I was in the Art and Social Practice program, I went for a summer and worked at Apple for like 4 months, and then I was working at Nike for a bit, and I was teaching here in the design program, which I loved. And then I was really burnt out on working in big corporate environments. So I was like, you know, maybe I could just like do freelance and teach. And like, that should be fine. Like, how much money do I actually need? And I was so broke.
Yeah, it's, and I think that was also right about the time that sort of things went through the ceiling,
yes.
Price-wise here.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I'm 40 and I'm really broke and this is not cool. So I was like, I guess I should get a job. So OMFG Co. had posted for an art director position and just kind of worked out.
Yeah. And you've been there like that was 2017, right?
No, I started there in fall of 2019.
2019.
So it's been 4.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you worked your way up to creative director.
Yes.
Yes.
Very quickly that happened.
So like, what have you been working on like while you've been there?
So many things. I mean, one of the really great things about OMFG Co. is we don't have one type of client that we work with. We work with lots of different types of clients on purpose, because I think we would get bored.
it's fair.
Yeah, we like to learn about new things, and I think it also allows us to like come into industries or thinking about products from angles that maybe haven't been thought of before, because we're coming in with sort of like as outsiders with a beginner's mind, and that maybe allows us to like find stories that haven't already been told.
You know, that's an interesting angle that I haven't really thought about. Like, if it is just a, you know, we do branding for, say, the hat industry.
Yeah.
There's only so many hat clients that you can work with where you're able to come up with new solutions.
Yeah,
I would think that starts to feel really stale very
for
quickly.
Sure. Yeah. So I've been lucky to work on lots of different types of interesting projects. You know, like last year we did a snorkel store in Maui.
All right.
We've done like a fancy Italian bedding line. We do a lot of independent hotels and hospitality. You know, we have like a cannabis kind of side of things that is kind of ongoing, bars, restaurants. We're doing a food hall in Peru right now. We're doing a couple hotels. Yeah.
So it's just, it's global work too.
It's global work. Yeah. We did a big project in Singapore last year.
Damn. All right.
Which was awesome. We got to go to Singapore for a week, which was like the best trip ever.
It sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
And I assume to take in this hotel's amenities and really get the full lay of the land.
Yes.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, we're doing research while we're there, right? So we go to these, I mean, that part of the job is maybe my most favorite because it like bleeds into my social practice interest in a way, because we're literally just talking to whoever we can while we're there, trying to understand the context of these places, because that's how you make good work. The more you understand it, the better you know who you're talking to and what's missing and all of those things.
Yes,
so,
please listen to this, students, please.
Yeah, yeah, the context is really important. So I love that part of it. And I love everybody I work with. I feel so lucky to work with people that are inspiring and like, also we don't take ourselves too seriously. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
We're good at our jobs and we want to do a good job. And we want to find interesting stories to tell and all of that. But also, it's design at the end of the day. And like, nobody's going to live or die by it.
No. I mean, if they are, something's gone terribly wrong.
I mean, we could go on a tangent and talk about like, you know, how marketing, like, you know, people maybe do live and die by design.
True.
But
someone designs a hat and it's full of knives. That's bad. Don't do that.
Propaganda, for example. Know, we could go down a whole tunnel. But for branding, the work that we're doing, like...
I like how your example was real and mine was hat full of knives.
You know, it's just all angles.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how the knives have to be inside the hat.
Yeah, all angles.
There's no stable surface in hat. It's all curved.
Oh, man. So yeah, those trips are always really fun. Yeah.
Yeah. You also mentioned maybe you've made some design mistakes there as well.
Yeah. One that came to mind when I was asking you, can I swear? This is...
I like how I reactively answered the question again.
So we were doing a presentation to a client one time and I was screen sharing and I forgot that I was screen sharing. And
oh no.
I think the producer or someone had sent over a PDF to the client that was the wrong PDF. It wasn't the final one. And it had some part of our work or our branding that we had taken out because we didn't like it. And
oh,
and
no.
So it was in this presentation and it showed up and And they loved it, of course.
Yeah.
And don't ever show anything you don't want them to pick, because they'll pick it.
I actually don't think I've told my story of the laser card on this project.
Okay.
This was a very early project for me. It was right after I graduated. Mm-hmm. My roommate worked for the card services at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Okay.
And he asked me, would I design the new ID card for the campus? And that's an R1 university.
Yeah.
And there's, you know,
that's a big deal.
Like 50,000 cards
people
are
going to
get printed
it.
With that design. And so I'm like, okay. And, you know, I never get to meet with any of the people who actually work there apart from him. Mm-hmm. So in hindsight, that's a little bit of a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so young. I didn't mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. But you know, I put together a couple of proposals and I showed them to him. And at some point we mutually agreed that two is not the right number of proposals that you should show. You should show three,
mm-hmm.
Comedy rule of threes, all that, mm-hmm. All the good advice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, with him doing a goof, made a fun one that we called the laser card because it was just full of bullshit.
Oh, no.
Full of lasers and...
What do you mean lasers?
Like gradients meant to evoke the idea of lasers.
Okay.
It looked bad even for the time.
Wow.
I think
and you
if it,
showed that to the client?
Well, I didn't show it to the client because I didn't get to meet the
right,
client.
Right.
Another very broken part of this process. So he takes the deck and he goes and he shows it to them, and they love the laser card. They love it more than anything. So I basically spend the next 3 months trying to figure out how to make the laser card good.
Oh my goodness.
And it doesn't ever work.
No.
But, yeah.
See? Lessons learned.
But yeah, don't just put random bullshit in front of the clients because they'll love it.
They'll love it, and
whatever
then you're stuck
it
with it.
Yeah.
I guess just don't show it on your portfolio.
Hat full of knives? Wow. An innovation. Finally, so, I don't need to keep knives outside of my hat. I can keep them as close to my head as possible.
Yeah, what's happening?
I don't know. I think there might be a gas leak.
So, okay, so I'm screen sharing, and this page comes up that we had taken out, and they love it. And I forgot that I was screen sharing, so I get on Slack, because we use Slack all the time, and I write to my team, and I wrote, fuck, like super, like 18 U's and C's. And then I was like, before I sent it, I was like, too strong, deleted it, and then I wrote shit and sent it, and then Fritz was like, Kim, you're screen sharing.
Oh no.
And
you're,
I was like,
still screen sharing the oh no.
So the lesson is to know when you're screen sharing or not, and maybe just don't send those messages while you're on the call, just in case.
I think that's actually a really really safe bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always the time when you are expressing some frustration after a bad client meeting that the client is still on the call,
yeah,
or
something bad's gonna happen.
Uh-huh.
Fritz still brings it up. He thinks it's so funny. And I was like mortified.
I appreciate that you backed out the fuck, so you're mm-hmm. not getting the R rating.
No.
Although you do get one of those.
But they saw me do all
PG-13.
That. They saw me write fuck and delete it and then write shit.
You tried so hard. And went so far. But in the end, it doesn't really matter.
It does. It's all fine.
No.
They were a shitty client anyways, honestly. So.
Well, it's appropriate choice of word.
Exactly.
So that's, I mean, that's a good reminder that that's the kind of thing that happens at all levels in this field.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
In the end, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
You're
Kim.
So welcome.
If people want to find more about your work, where do they go to do that?
Well, they can go to my website, which has not been updated in quite some time. Once in a while I put a new thing on there, but it really needs an update. But it's KimberlySutherland.com.
Famously graphic designers do not update their websites.
Yeah, who's
very
got the time
often. Yeah, it's
and Rural, if you want to learn more about that, I have an Instagram account for that, rural-series. And also just shoot me an email.
Yeah. And if people, like we mentioned before, you are doing a new podcast with OMFG Co.
Yes.
What was the title again? I remember the exclamation point and the question mark.
And then what?
And then what?
Question mark. It's about people's creative journeys.
So where can people find that, when it will come out, and when will it drop?
Well, it's going to drop, I would say, in the next couple weeks. And we're going to have it on the OMFG Co. journal page on our website. And then we'll probably end up putting it on Apple Podcasts or something like that, but yet to be determined.
Yes. So yeah, go check that out when it comes out. Yeah. And follow the OMFG Co journal, because that's where it's going to be.
There's always
going to
be new things on there. So
yeah,
enjoy the journal.
enjoy the journal, not the destination.
Yes.
Well, thank you again.
You're
so much
welcome.
For being here, Kim.
Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you here. Now I get to read the end. Thank you to our listeners. If you've got a moment, please rate, review, and subscribe to this show wherever you heard it. Ratings and reviews in particular are a big help. And sharing it with a friend is an even bigger one. Spread the good word. If there's maybe somewhere else that you'd rather hear the show, why not visit dididothat.design and check out the myriad options. Did you know that we have a YouTube channel? Most people don't. Is there video there? No. Don't get excited. I don't have that kind of time. This is also, you know, the best place where you can find some images that go along with each and every episode, which is to say the website, not the YouTube channel. And also, hey, get linked out to where we are on LinkedIn, Instagram, and more. This has been Did I Do That? I'm Sean Schumacher. And as we always say at the close of every episode.
What do we say? Shit, Sean, you didn't tell me about what we say.
That's what we say. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
What article are you looking for?
The skimboarding
for?
One.
Oh, the skimboarding.
Oh.
Oh, it's right there. A gift from the board gods, of course.
How embarrassing.
I think part of the problem is also I don't know what skimboarding is, so I didn't know.
Well, you take this little board and you skim it along, like, usually a tide pool or something like that, and then you jump on it and you can do tricks and you can do rails.
Oh, like you're, like, skipping a rock.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, pretty fun.
I had no idea.
My husband thought that was really funny, and he found a skimboard for at the thrift store and gave it to me for, like, a birthday present one year, and I was like, this is unacceptable. We'll be right back.